For this week's podcast, we're back at Jazz FM for October's Roundtable.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Hello, I'm Trevor Dan. On the agenda this week, Radio 1 Vintage. Was it a refreshing blend or a bit corked? What do we make of the two new podcasts from Jeff Lloyd? He's a former editor of the other Today programme, the one on Radio 4, right to criticise its new direction, and much more. With me are three stellar figures from our industry. We have Radio's own Statto, the Duckworth Lewis of audio analysis. We have Radio's own James Dyson, who's busy turning your car's onboard computer back into a radio. And we have one of the pioneers of our business who was featured in a BBC TV documentary this week. And I'm not talking about blood on the carpet. Let's meet them.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Hello, I'm Adam Bowie. I'm a commercial strategy manager at the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Michael Hill. I'm from Radio Player.
Hello, I'm Jez Nelson. I'm the founder and CEO of content company Something Else and a Jazz FM presenter. In fact, I record my programme in this very studio.
And while you've mentioned it, you should give it a plug.
My programme, it's called Something Else. It's Sunday nights at 10 o'clock until 1 in the morning. Lots of weird, esoteric, wonderful music.
I've been trying to get you on this show for a while, Jez, and you're always fantastically busy. You just said content company, Something Else. Is that how you see yourselves now? Because you do so much more than just radio.
Well, we talk about ourselves as a content company and an audience business, which sounds a bit, maybe a little bit crass if you're radio professionals like we all are. And obviously, we know that we engage with audiences. That's what it's all about. But a lot of the work we do these days is with brands, and they're starting to understand that it's better to engage with consumers as audiences as opposed to just customers, and so that's why we describe ourselves like that. But yes, we do lots of TV, social media, and of course lots and lots of audio too.
I think we probably all thought maybe a decade ago that companies like yours would probably drop radio because there was no money in it. Why do you keep doing it?
Well, that's definitely true. There's very little money. I mean, I think the thing about radio, or yeah, let's call it radio as opposed to audio, is that actually right now there's so much more opportunity for everybody, whether you're a presenter or somebody's got an idea you just want to get out there, or whether you're a company like ours that makes stuff. There's a lot more opportunity, but yes, the budgets are a lot lower. So we make it work by having scale. We do lots of stuff. We have a lot of people who work for us in-house, and so we can make it work. The other thing is for us is that it is absolutely a kind of the bedrock of everything we do. So much of what we've done in other areas, whether it be television or social media, has grown out of the passion and enthusiasm of the people who work for us who are into music or gardening or films or whatever. And at the end of the day, it's still my favourite medium, and as long as I'm there, we will do radio, even if we have to pay the BBC to do it, which we pretty much do at the moment.
Yeah. Right, Adam, let me start with you talking about, if I may, Radio 1 Vintage. This was the pop-up DAB service that was on for 3 days last weekend. What did you make of it?
I thought it was pretty spectacular. I mean, actually, there was so much of it, I almost felt overwhelmed at times.
There's 50 programmes, 50 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. And you looked at that schedule, which they did very nicely in a sort of vintage style, and you just thought, wow, there's so much here. And, you know, a lot of it was not just music, you know, it was more than music. So
what they did was they recorded some contemporary interviews with many of the people who were about to be featured, and then they'd do an hour of Emperor Roscoe and an hour of Simon Bates and an hour of Colin and Edith or whatever it was. Do you think that worked as a radio station, or was it a selection of little podcasts?
I think in reality, you're going to tune in and tune out depending on what your era was. They mixed it up. It wasn't as though, you know, you start at the beginning and work your way through to the end. And I think, you know, in the same way everyone has their Doctor Who, you have your Radio 1 breakfast show presenter or whatever, and it's your era. So, you know, I listen to a bit of Simon Mayo, for example, who's on the radio daily anyway, but, you know, hearing the Radio 1 breakfast show that I used to listen to.
Mike?
Well, I've spent all weekend with a smile on my face. I spent 8 years at Newsbeat at Radio 1, and I've been on the Facebook group this weekend swapping stories with all my ex-colleagues from there. You know, I got to about half an hour through the Newsbeat segment of Radio 1 Vintage, and suddenly it was like digging down to the strata that's relevant to you. You know, you start hitting dinosaur bones, hearing jingles I'd mixed, hearing, you know, scripts on air that I'd written, hearing presenters I'd worked with, and it just fired off all the memories, and I became that awful old reminiscy radio fart.
You, of course, you've been a manager and executive at the BBC as well. So putting yourself in Ben Cooper's place, why do you think Radio 1 decided to do this? Because, you know, a little while ago, the mood was, well, it's going to be our 50th birthday, but that's the last thing we want to tell our young audience about.
Mm. Well, it was interesting the way they did it. I mean, I said to my wife, Radio 1 Vintage is on. She said, oh, great, and automatically tuned the DAB to Radio 1. And, of course, that's where you'd assume you'd find it. But they did a separate pop-up service called Radio 1 Vintage. I think that gave them license to be reminiscing old farts out on the radio. And meanwhile, I didn't actually tune in very much to Radio 1 and hear what was going on the main channel. Anyone else do that? I suspect that it would have been much more contemporary and normal on the main Radio 1. And so I think that's why they allowed it to happen.
Yes.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's a really sort of tricky one for them to get to grips with, I think, for Ben Cooper and also for Lewis Carney to think, how do we actually mark, you know, the anniversary of Radio 1 and Radio 2 together? And, you know, I think it was a clever way that they did it. I thought the schedule was really interesting. And also, you know, yes, you had the Emperor Roscoe and, you know, you had Kenny Everett, but you also had people like, you know, Fabio and Groove Rider. So you did reflect the different generations. I think you do ask a question. It'd be really interesting to know whether they'll ever release any figures. I mean, who was it for? Was it for the kind of radio anoraks in this room? Or was it actually for an audience? You know, is there any sense in which there's an audience demand to sort of hear that? That doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing to do, to kind of celebrate. It deserves celebrating, but it's kind of interesting to think what they ended up doing, if actually people really wanted to hear that. I did hear some of the... I don't know whether it was simulcast, but I heard Simon Mayo with Sarah Cox on Radio 2, and that was really nice, and it's kind of, you know, nostalgic stuff. So, yeah, a hard one to pull off.
I tuned in on Monday morning to hear Simon Bates doing an hour tune, and I realised just why that radio station had to change when it did in the 90s. Did
Incredible.
Anybody agree with me?
I just found the whole thing, there was an amazing diversity of content, wasn't there, and difference of styles across the years. But then I remembered, you know, it's like a decade station on listening to absolute 70s. You're only listening to less than 1% of the actual musical output of that decade. So listening to that condensation of Radio 1 from 50 years, you were listening to a very small fragment of it and very much the best stuff from Radio 1. And there was probably an awful lot of other stuff around all that.
It's so tricky as well, isn't it? Because you mentioned Blood on the Carpet earlier on, but, you know, I know there was, you know, the anniversary was coming up and there was a lot of talk about what about, you know, the definitive series or documentary about Radio 1. And, of course, it's very hard to go there without covering some what have become incredibly, you know, tragic and controversial stuff. And so they sort of had to stay clear of that because actually, you know, that would have been a fascinating TV documentary
or
series or something.
The point I was going to raise here, which was it all a bit self-congratulatory? I mean, you can't really ask Radio 1 to do the definitive documentary about themselves, can you? Because they're never going to do that. But was it a bit too soft, Adam?
It wouldn't have been right to have done anything different. I think you're right. If you do that definitive series, it's probably not going to be on Radio 1 for starters. You know, it goes back to, does a 19-year-old today really care about the history? Some of them do, by the way, but, you know, and if only for the fact that their dad or their mum's piping up suddenly remembering when they were listening to it, you know, there is that continuity. But, you know, it probably is a TV series or it will sit on Radio 2. It probably won't sit on Radio 1 ever, and it's worth doing.
Tell me about what the current audience is compared to maybe 20 years ago.
OK, so I did have a look at this, and in reach terms, actually, compared to 20 years ago, it's about the same. Now, that it should be said, that was, there's a couple of qualifiers. It's Rajar methodology was different 20 years ago, so you shouldn't really strictly compare it. And that was coming in the first quarter, if you do it exactly 20 years, that's coming the first quarter of Mark and Lard being on Radio 1 after Chris Evans had left, and that probably wasn't the most successful time of Radio 1's breakfast show. So I then looked to the furthest you could compare it with, which was about 99. And from there, you're down from about 11 million to now just over, it's 9.6 million. But the real change is in hours, where the hours now are about, last quarter, 38% down of where they were 18 wow. years ago. And that's really the challenge, Radio 1. And it's not just Radio 1, it's anyone targeting younger demographics. It's listening time.
Are those people who've gone consuming the Radio 1 brand, but on different platforms?
So there's certainly a lot of that. And if you talk to Ben Cooper and his team,
well, that's what he'd say.
Yeah, and you look at the numbers, and you know, definitely, you know, they get big YouTube numbers, although, you know, from afar, you can't tell if that's just Americans watching an American star who happens to be on Radio 1 YouTube channel. But, you know, you have to face facts that in 1997 or 1999, there was less FM radio to listen to. It certainly wasn't DAB. We have many more choices, sub-brands of existing brands. And never mind free or inexpensive, relatively inexpensive, on-demand audio services like Spotify.
Is it still relevant, Jez?
Well, I think what's absolutely relevant is a service or a range of quality services targeted at a young audience. And obviously that's the sort of transition that's going on. I think many of the things that happen on Radio 1, whether that be on radio or on the various other platforms where they now live, are absolutely right for the audience. But I do know that I think that there's even maybe some more research coming that will say that, you know, they're absolutely sort of kind of hemorrhaging young audiences. So I think there is time for some sort of radical thought. I mean, I do think that Ben Cooper has done a very, very good job of shifting kind of activity and money into other platforms, but it's a tricky one. You know, how do you get in front of those audiences? And I think the BBC are going to have to move quicker and think more radically, and be prepared to kind of break through all kinds of taboos and rules in order to do some quick thinking to get in front of those audiences, you know, because it's tipping so massively rapidly.
Mike, what does Radio Player tell you about Radio 1?
Ooh, that's a great question. And I'm not going to share the data that we can see about Radio 1 because that's private to the BBC. What I can tell you is that very rarely does a pop-up station of any kind, whether run by the BBC or others, make a massive dent on the radio listening universe. My bet is that this will probably have been the most successful pop-up station ever. That's just my gamble. I have no idea.
Jez, you mentioned Blood on the Carpet, so let me just return the favour and mention The Last Pirates, which is BBC 4's documentary about land-based dance music pirate radio. You were in it.
Briefly.
With very, rather very, more hair than you have now.
Yeah.
Lovely to see Trevor Nelson with hair and yep. a moustache. I've forgotten that. So this was the story of the pirate radio stations of basically the 80s.
Yeah.
Many things came out of that for me. One was this real sort of sense of disappointment with what had happened to KISS, that it started off being so revolutionary, and the mood of the programme, at least, was to say, do you know what, just got swallowed up by the establishment.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's a different moment. It's hard to think back to that. And obviously I was involved in that at a time when all you had in London was like Capital and LBC, right? And so, you know, if you were into black music, which is what these stations are about, you had to really hunt it out. And there were just a few programmes all over the place. So it was such a massive kind of groundswell. And the programme tells the story of how, you know, the government and the authorities tried to deny this, and there was this constant cat and mouse between the DTI and the pirates. And then you kind of get to the late 80s, and after a sort of series of false starts, these licenses are issued. And in fact, it's a good moment in the programme where you think KISS, who've at this point got this sort of momentum behind them, are going to get the license, and they don't. It's Jazz FM, which is, I benefited from that because I then went on to Jazz FM. I had a glorious 18 months when no one else was on air and we had all the listeners because we were the first new commercial radio station to come along. But of course, you know, Spectrum in every sense in those days was so rare pre-DAB that as soon as KISS got the license, very quickly EMAP moved in, the money moved in. I saw exactly the same happen at Jazz FM, the original Jazz FM when I was there, you know, changing ownership very quickly, dilution of the brand, money talks, you know, people at KISS take, you know, money, and of course, and so, you know, disappeared because at that point, I mean, I don't really know the intricacies of it nowadays, but at that point, that was incredibly valuable Spectrum. And so KISS, which was a wonderful thing as a pirate, and in the first couple of years when it was legal, got very quickly kind of watered down. And it was a massive disappointment because a lot of people had put in, you know, 10, 15 years of effort into this. And it felt like something, I don't know, maybe I can't think of another example really in British broadcasting where this had so much come up from the ground, from the streets. It came out of the clubs and the record shops. Everybody wanted this to happen. I remember the day Kiss went on air, it was a huge thing. And I don't know, have we ever recovered? Of course, the great thing is, as they say in the programme, is, you know, you can't keep that stuff down. And it does, it comes from all kinds of music, but it particularly comes from dance music and black music, and you can't keep it down. So now you've got Rinse, fantastic, that come along in the next wave.
What you have got, though, now is a revolutionised, revitalised Radio 1 compared with the Radio 1 of the day when you were trying to pull audience from it, because it just wasn't playing your kind of music. Whereas now, I think you would argue that it's doing more of that than it used to.
I mean, I think the story of, you know, the BBC to extent, and you understand it because it's such a big, you know, lovely, brilliant, but sometimes lumbering organisation that, you know, it will get really behind, and then there'll be, boom, a big moment. And there was this big moment in dance music, which basically Radio 1 had ignored, and then all of a sudden, overnight, everything changed, you know. And yes, the Pirates undoubtedly changed Radio 1. They, you know, they led ultimately to the creation of One Extra and so many other things. Now everything's different because there's outlets for everything everywhere, but yet the pirate scene is still very strong.
Jez Nelson is here, so is Mike Hill and Adam Bowie. We are the Radio Today programme. It's the October Roundtable, and we'll take a small commercial message and then talk about Jeff Lloyd.
Phone calls, social media, SMS, email, codec control and visualisation through the same interface. Phone box from Broadcast Bionics. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk.
So it's the old London buses gag. Two come along at once. Two podcasts featuring Jeff Lloyd. The first one, Adrift, with his old Absolute Radio sidekick, Annabelle. And then, extraordinarily, I didn't see this coming, Reasons to be Cheerful with Jeff Lloyd and Ed Miliband. Adam Bowie.
Well, I'll hold my hands up first of all and say Jeff's a bit of a friend of mine. So with that said...
He says the same of you.
Excellent. So that's good. We're on the same page. Yeah, I think, as you say, probably the more interesting, or the one that didn't come through, was the Ed Miliband one. And I think just following on from Ed Miliband being on Radio 2 a few weeks back and actually making a few waves at the time... And the fact that Jeff had met him and known him from previously from interviewing on Absolute means that, you know, it is an interesting one, and I think it works really well. I think they're trying to do something a little bit different. I think it will be
just describe it for
a Yeah, it's a big ideas podcast, really, but a big ideas with humour. It's not being trying to be. It's trying to reach quite a wide audience. It sounds like a radio programme. It's well structured. The pace is fast.
And it's Jeff and Ed.
It's Jeff and Ed.
Are they in one of Ed's kitchens?
I think they're in Jeff's new attic studio or whatever. And they'll get an author on or someone who... And they're seeking new ideas, and then they'll sort of shoot the breeze on it a little bit. And then they're also getting a comedian on just to keep it a bit wider and a bit open. And I think, actually, in the first couple of episodes, there's only been two so far, it really works. And Ed Miliband is actually a really good broadcaster.
We are talking about technology, how to regulate it, Uber, you know, the recent decision by Sadiq Khan to ban Uber in London, at least temporarily, because of they were breaching, he said, license conditions. So we'll be talking about that. And you know, is there a more creative alternative to Uber? You know, should there be a what they call a public platform? How do we regulate these big companies like Facebook and Amazon and Google, which seem to take all our data? So we're going to talk about that with Nick Cernacek.
And who's he?
He's written a book called Platform Capitalism, which is about these kind of issues.
It is great to be able to just Google things, though, isn't it?
It is.
You know, I saw 90% of all searches are done on Google. Well, it's unbelievable that 10% of searches are done on something other than Google.
Is that Bing?
Yeah, I mean, who is using that? Sure, the only people...
Accidentally.
Yeah, it's
you
the ones,
end up with Bing.
Yeah,
oh, why have I got Bing?
Their phones are preset to use Bing instead.
Yeah, and you don't know how to reprogram it.
No,
that's happened to me.
I think podcasts can really help with a reappraisal of people somehow. They're a very kind of free-form format. I mean, Ed absolutely human and funny, but also strange to hear the dynamic, because you'd expect Jeff, having been a radio host, to be interviewing Ed in some way, but that's absolutely not the case. They're equal co-hosts, and in many ways, Ed steps forward to the mic at times when Jeff is leaning back, and I absolutely love that. So, and his other one as well, Jeff's other one, called Adrift, is a brilliant premise for a podcast. You know, the Venn diagram of podcast listeners and socially awkward people probably has quite a lot in the middle, I would say.
How dare he?
So, you know, there's lots of us who listen, and you know, for those of you who haven't heard it, it's about being socially awkward, and it's a much more structured offering than the other one, Reasons to Be Cheerful. It's got sort of zones of content, like the incident where he relates something that's happened, and it's really well produced. Jeff's a brilliant radio craftsman, and it really hangs together well as a piece of radio.
My wife then goes to put our name down, and she's told there will be a 40-minute wait.
Mm.
But it's a nice day.
Okay.
There's nothing better to do. I say, well, let's do it. So she says, great. So we're in the queue. And then she says, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the park with Maggie and the baby and go on the swings, and you can ring us when the table becomes available.
Okay.
What do you mean, okay? Isn't that the worst thing you've ever heard?
No, I think that's okay.
No, it's not okay, because it just fills me with anxiety. So, first of all, they say 40 minutes.
Right.
But that's probably like an outside guess. What if they mean 20 minutes?
Okay, yeah.
So, firstly, it's not a tangible amount of time.
Right.
It's like when you need a wee. You know roughly how long a wee is going to last, mm. but sometimes it surprises you.
Okay, yeah.
And I think a queue is very much the same thing.
Okay.
I'm left in this queue worrying that it's going to take less time and then they're not going to be here. And then I'm worrying that when we get to the front,
yeah,
she's going to call out and call our name. All right, table for four, Jeff. And then I'll say, oh, the others are just in the park. I'm just going to call them.
Oh.
And she then will reply, oh, well, we can't seat you until the full table, the full party is here.
Which I've known to happen.
It does happen, because that's the sensible way to do it. And then what happens? We get bumped back to the end of the queue again.
No.
Well, for me, actually, it was very much kind of game of two halves, really. I really enjoyed the podcast with Ed Miliband. And as you say, it was a kind of unexpected sort of delight, really. And the fact that Ed Miliband is kind of changing in front of our eyes like this. And actually, he's got kind of, you get the sense of someone who's got nothing to lose. He's kind of lost the thing that, you know, he really wanted. And
bit
so now
balls, really, you know, suddenly became a bit of a favourite.
He's just kind of, and he's obviously very clever, but actually he's got a very, very good way of explaining potentially quite complicated concepts in a natural way. He does feel like a natural broadcaster. And I agree, you kind of get the sense he's very much like it's an even thing. The other one for me was really troublesome. I mean, maybe I haven't given it long enough, but I think, you know what it made me think of? It made me think of those, the two of them, because they were a double act, right, on Absolute. It made me think of someone coming into the studio and removing all of the architecture of the studio, taking away, you know, the desk, taking away the music and the adverts and everything, and just leaving these two people in the studio talking to it. It felt a bit sad and a bit awkward, and she sounded very scripted.
That's the point. It's called Adrift. It's for socially awkward. That's their
shtick. But I thought it just, you said it was well produced. I didn't think it was. It sounded like all the crap stuff that I don't like about, you know, breakfast radio, without the kind of expectation that, oh good, they're going to play a good record. Okay. Or something.
I mean,
like,
I think
interesting what come up. I just thought, you know, this is why, yeah,
it's not for you.
It's a direct extension. It is a direct extension of the radio show, and you either like or you don't like the radio show, because actually, yes, there's a construct to it, but in reality, if you listen to the radio show, and particularly the podcast, you know, which was successful, so I think, you know, this is a direct follow-on. They left the station. Yeah. This is for listeners to them, and obviously then they're trying to grow it beyond that. But
I think if you're looking for something which is two people whiffling on, I think Jane Garvey and Fee Glover are better at it, because there's no work been put into it whatsoever.
that was the thing for me. The sort of spontaneous moments about some, you know, there's a thing about things that happened in my childhood. They didn't sound smart. You know, they sound like I've written every word of this down. I'm going to read it out.
Let's move on to Sound Digital. They're advertising for two new radio stations. Now, has anybody got an idea for a new format that we can take to a venture capitalist this afternoon? Who wants to go first?
I think they should put Corrupt FM on there.
Okay, tell us about Corrupt FM.
Which is the fictional radio station, which is in People Just Do Nothing. The brilliant BBC comedy series. And actually, I'm sort of only half joking, because that out of the back of that series, which if you haven't seen, it's about a bunch of guys led by someone called MC Grinder, who run a grime station in London, Pirate Radio again. And off the back of that, they've become hugely successful in playing festivals and clubs. I genuinely mean that I think it's a way which some sort of young people are learning about radio. I mean, my kids absolutely love it. And actually, I think if you put Corrupt FM on, it'll do really well.
I've got lots of ideas, but I'm going to keep them to myself and take them to my own venture capitalist.
I think it would be very dangerous for anyone to actually go along with a brand new brand to something like this. A lot of people try it, but now the radio market is digital has allowed us to have quite a lot of stations. You know, if I look at my own DAB set at home, I've got over 100 services on. Mm. So just appearing and adding yourself to a platform like Sound Digital, you know, on a serious level, is not enough. And marketing a station nationally, as many of us who've worked at national stations will know, is expensive. So, which is why, unfortunately, you've seen so many stations which are just sort of sister stations, you know, and you wonder what the next, you know, Absolute or the next Heart might be. But, you know, the reality is actually that's probably the safer thing to do, because going there with a brand new format, at least if it's a traditional broadcast radio format, is probably a hard thing to win over the venture capitalists. Now, if you do something a little bit different and try and go off and radio is a part of it, or radio stations effectively the marketing for another arm of your business, then I think there's some interesting ideas
like
there.
For instance, Channel 4 Radio.
Yes.
Who would have thought?
Or Team Rock. Yes.
You were at Channel 4 Radio.
I was at Channel 4 Radio until the global recession hit and Channel 4 retrenched back to what it was doing at the core, and sacked us all, which was a bit of a shock. But yeah, that would have been a...
It have worked?
It would definitely have worked, yeah. And something like E4 Radio today, I think, would have been a very successful radio station with millions of listeners.
I did have another thought, which is, you guys in the know, how much does it cost? What would it cost to be on there?
Healthy six-figure sum, at least, I would think.
Okay. I had an idea, which is Worldwide FM, which is Giles Peterson's radio station, which is nominated for an ARIA this year. It's very interesting because he's sort of set that up, you know, just online, a bit like NTS, and he's got this kind of notion of just the world that he's involved in, which is like great musical people all around the world just dropping in and doing programs. And so I think that's interesting, you know, one of those sort of brands, a kind of a Worldwide FM or an NTS, which is sort of what you're talking about. They're a bit more nascent than obviously Absolutes or your Jazz FMs, but someone like that maybe. But I don't know, the economics probably don't stack up at that kind of price.
I just spent a couple of weeks in the States, and I had Sirius in my car, and that's when you realise what it's like dealing with a radio set, as you describe, with as many channels as a skybox. I just wanted to, because it is today, I just wanted to play this clip.
In 2015, Tom Petty launched his very own SiriusXM channel, Tom Petty Radio. In 2016, he was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Just a week ago, Tom completed the critically acclaimed Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers 40th anniversary tour at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. For more insight into Tom's career and his music, tune in to Tom Petty Radio on SiriusXM Channel 31. SiriusXM remembers Tom Petty, who passed away at the age of 66.
Some of you may know this is our 40th anniversary tour we're on this time.
Another performance from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers 2017 tour, exclusively on SiriusXM's Tom Petty Radio.
Well, he'll be missed, but actually I did listen to that station while I was in America, and I was thinking just how niche radio has become. Who would have thought you could have an entire channel dedicated just to Tom Petty and people he likes?
Well, actually, joining up some dots, we actually produce a programme called Get Back with Jeff Lloyd about the Beatles. There's a whole Beatles channel now, which is just launched, and we do a show which is about the... It's kind of trying to give the very much the UK perspective on the Beatles, which is good because they're British, but kind of give that flavour in a network which is entirely dedicated to their music. But they've got, I can't remember, there's another one, there's a few others.
I think it's their amazing Beatles channel that uses the little catch line, Beatle hits 24/7, 8 days a week. Let's move on, if we may, then to the Radio 4 Today programme. Hands up anybody who wakes up with the Radio 4 Today programme. It's all of us. OK. But we all complain about it. Roger Moses is the latest ex-editor to have a pop at it for getting a bit soft and a bit girly. I mean, he didn't use that phrase, but it's being used by other people about what is happening to Radio 4 Today programme since it's got a female editor. I don't know whether that's right or not. Adam, you're looking quizzical. It's what people are saying. It's not my view.
Yeah, I'm not sure that. I mean, I think clearly there have been some changes. There's someone new come in and she's not from radio, so they're trying some different things.
Sarah Sands, by the way, former editor of the Evening Standard.
The difficulty is, if you like, the news at the moment can be oppressively dull. You know, I mean, we're recording on a particularly poor day. But, you know, even with things like Brexit, people are not necessarily energised and engaged. Well, let's hear what they're talking about in negotiations today. So trying to do something different, you know, is to be encouraged, I think, you know, and everyone's going to put their mark on it. Every new editor puts their mark on it. And it's probably too early. I think, you know, you've got to measure these things in months and months, not a few weeks, you know. And, you know, personally, I'm not interested in Fashion Week either, but the reality is actually it's quite a big industry in the UK.
It did go on and nuts, though, didn't it?
Actually, one thing I will say is, and one thing that annoys me intensely, and is that not just today, but all breakfast speech radio, is when they try and shoehorn way too many items into a half hour, and you end up with someone right at the end who's got something quite interesting to say. Yeah, and absolutely. And that's it. And you kind of go, what? That person got up at 5 o'clock, got a cab in, and you let them speak for 10 seconds.
Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked in newsrooms in the BBC and elsewhere, actually, and there is a kind of newsroom culture. Roger Mosey is a brilliant man. I've worked with him. He's got a brain the size of a planet, and he can name the last 12 chancellors. And there is that kind of alpha intellectualism in most newsrooms in the BBC. And I think that's necessary. You have to be able to do those 10 past 8 interviews with Theresa May and know what you're talking about. But there's also a place for light and shade. And I welcome the bringing in of a bit of humanity to the Today programme. Whether the London Fashion Week is the right way to do it or not, I'm not sure.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I did hear that morning, funnily enough. And I did, because we actually work for Top Man, and I went in and I said to the guys in the brand, saying, my, did you hear that thing this morning? It was a really, really long item on Top Shop. And it did go on a bit. But I think, you know, the point is, as Roger Mosey says in his article, they're under such scrutiny when you're editing that programme. You're going to have it picked apart, and any small change is going to be noticed. So when you try and make quite big interventions, maybe just to try them out, then everybody kind of, you know, starts getting really, really uptight about it. And I think that, you know, yes, that was a bit over the top. You know, they did the thing from Silicon Valley, which was kind of a bit weightier, but again was quite a kind of, oh, that's interesting. And I think she's just sort of trying things out. And rather, you know what it's like when you know, we produce Gardener's Question Time for the BBC, and you're expected to do things very, very, very slowly. And sometimes the pace of change is supposed to be glacial. But then actually, occasionally, maybe you need to try things out, be a bit more kind of radical, and see what happens. And he says in his article, he lists a bunch of topics that, you know, post-hurricane crisis in Caribbean, human rights atrocities in Myanmar. He says the public sector pay rise, says these things didn't get much coverage. I don't know what he's talking about. You know, these things were very well covered. They had half an hour with Mark Carney, you know, the other day. You know, it's not as if they kind of made a massive dogleg and they're off doing some really light stuff. She's just trying a few things out.
I think there's a big difference between how normal people listen to the radio and how we listen professionally. And as Adam says, no one listens to 3 hours of the Today programme. And there are a lot of people who are on a bit of a hair trigger when they're listening to a format like this. And, you know, Roger's detected a change, a tremor in the kind of structure. And he's right, but it's not a huge change. And it certainly wouldn't be apparent to most people.
When are they going to come clean and start calling the 8:30 news the 8:36 news? What? Why can they never hit the half hour?
Does it matter, Rod? Does it matter?
It matters a little bit if you're going to... Anyway.
You must be... the fact that you can check that at that time in the morning, Trevor, it's good to know you have that time.
I'm sorry. Mike, your radio player thing I accused you of turning the onboard computer into a radio, but in a sense, that is what you're doing, isn't it? Very clever, your gizmo.
Well, radio listening in cars, massively important. 25% of the radio listening in this country and much more elsewhere. So, Radio Player, we're keen to try and help protect radio's place in the dashboard. And what your reference to a computer is quite right. What we're seeing is effectively connected tablets appearing in the middle of the dashboard where before there were knobs. And in some cases, car manufacturers are making really bad decisions about getting rid of the radio button, for example. So you have to try and, first of all, look away from the road, look at the touchscreen, find something called media, navigate three screens down to find, you know, something else called radio, and select your station, by which time you're extricating yourself from the wreckage of the crash that you've had. So, you know, it's not heading in a good direction in many cars. So we've worked recently with Audi, amongst others. Audi have a brilliant research and development department in Ingolstadt, in a kind of James Bond concrete bunker lair where they sort of test cars to destruction. It's an incredible place. And they've got a whole floor of people trying to make better radios, and we really welcome that. So we've been sending them data from radio player systems in all our 8 countries, so that they can surface things like logos, nice full untruncated station names on the screen, but also switch automatically between DAB, FM and streaming. So if you're driving around, you lose a DAB signal, the radio stays with your station of choice automatically. And it's called hybrid radio. We've been working a lot in that area, and it's great to see car companies like Audi putting it as a line fit product into their dashboards.
There'll be nobody here complaining about any of that, will there? Let's have another sponsor's message and then we'll find out what our guests have been listening to.
Visual Radio Smarter and Cheaper. Virtual Director from Broadcast Bionics combines your social media, messaging, photos, audio and videos with intelligent camera control and automated graphics. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk.
Let's start with Adam.
Okay, I've been listening to a couple of things. Two Shot Podcast, which is an interview program presented by the actor Craig Parkinson, probably best known from being in Line of Duty. And he's been talking to people, guests have included Vicky McClure, Michael Smiley, and they're about an hour long, roughly, and they're just long, very nice, very gentle interviews. And you think, why would I want to hear some actor talking to some of his other actor lovey friends? But actually, it's not that. He's very down to earth. It is about actors and acting, and particularly about how they got into the business. And that's not something I would say I'm actually really that interested in. But this is really listenable. He begins every episode sort of saying, you know, put the kettle on, we're going to have a nice chat. And then he will talk to, say, Neil Morrissey in one of, I think it might have been the first episode. And Neil Morrissey, now I didn't know a great deal about him. Yes, he was in Men Behaving Badly. He also was in Line of Duty. I mean, they are friends of Craig Parkinson's, I think, to a certain extent. He has a fascinating background. You know, he came from a very broken sort of childhood, and the way he got into acting really kind of changed his life. And it's at length, so you can really get into these subjects, whereas, you know, certainly in most other interview formats, you just don't have that time.
Here we are in a lovely hotel room in one of my favourite cities, Manchester.
Why is it one of your favourite cities?
Well, do you know, when I was younger, I would, as a treat, get the train from Blackpool into Manchester, and whenever I heard the guy on the train go, "You're now coming into Manchester Piccadilly," I used to feel a rush of excitement.
Really?
And I still get it now when I get off. But I used to go to Affleck's Palace and try and find a nice cheap pair of kickers for 20 quid, which was really hard, you know.
Well, I kind of have the opposite thing, because I did 2 years up here, two spates of 6 months when I was doing that programme, Waterloo Road. And I hated that show. I hated it so much.
So therefore you have that affiliation with Manchester.
Exactly. My association with it now is, even my missus says to me, "You've got to get out of this show because it's making you into a nasty person."
You a nasty person?
Yeah. I was angry on set every day because the scripts, the delivery of the scripts and the quality of the scripts was so awful, and I was tied into it. So it's like being forced into sort of, it's like forced labour.
That's a clip from Craig Parkinson's Two Shot, is that what it's called?
Two Shot Podcast.
Another one from you, Adam.
Yeah, The Butterfly Effect with John Ronson. Now, this is, I'd say, I'd describe it as a podcast, except for it's an Audible exclusive, I think, at the moment. So you have to pay for it or use a credit on Audible to listen to it. But it's a six-part documentary series. And The Butterfly Effect is that thing that a small change somewhere has a massive change somewhere else. And it's the whole series is on one subject, and it's on pornography, and actually pornography effectively becoming free and very available. Now, there have been many documentaries, particularly TV documentaries, about pornography, and actually I kind of think, oh, you're really using it as an excuse to just show us some pornography, really, and bump your ratings up a little bit. This is a radio, so that doesn't apply. And actually, the stories he's telling and the way he's telling them are great. And he's had, you know, he's a broadcaster, we know, we've heard him on Radio 4, he's done pieces for This American Life. This is largely, but not exclusively, American set. And each episode kind of brings you a different effect of what actually happened.
This story started for me when I happened to see a man glance at a woman. Nobody was supposed to notice the glance, but by chance, I did. It happened in a Los Angeles hotel lobby one evening in January 2013. The woman was there to meet me. She was a veteran porn performer, and I was interviewing her for a different story. The hotel receptionist telephoned my room to tell me that my guest was waiting for me in the lobby. I went downstairs and spotted her straight away. Her dress was bright blue and very tight. Everybody else in the lobby was dressed in inconspicuous colours. She seemed so otherworldly, like a great mad peacock. I walked towards her. That's when I noticed the glance. It was the hotel receptionist. I just happened to swing around as he was looking at her. It was a look of total contempt.
John Ronson's The Butterfly Effect. Thank you, Adam. Over to Mike Hill.
Just the one from me. I've been listening to Russell Brand's new podcast, Under the Skin. I think it launched in spring. It is dangerous.
BBC man listens to Russell Brand.
No, it's you know, back to that thing we talked about earlier about podcasts driving a reappraisal of someone. I think it's well worth a listen. If you remember him from the radio broadcasting he's done, give it a go. It's an ideas podcast, you know, a bit like the one that we were talking about earlier from Jeff. And Russell Brand plus an interviewee talking for either 20 minutes or an hour and a half, whatever it's worth, really. Totally flexible format. He's had anarchism, Marxism, sex, God, veganism, art, music. Billy Bragg's come in, Al Gore's come in, Naomi Klein's come in. Really getting some really hard hitters in into his house and talking about stuff. And I think you should give it a listen just to hear what happens. He's obviously on a personal journey himself, and he has that intellectualism. He's also got that kind of sense that he's swallowed a dictionary still there as well. So, you know, he's sort of tripping over his own words. But he's like a kind of newborn foal exploring, you know, massive intellectual ideas, just tripping around the forest and nibbling at that and jumping over that and shagging that. It's fantastic.
Okay, here's a clip.
When something happens, like on your journey here, like where the taxi is late or it's like, I don't know, things don't go your way, the material world doesn't respond in accordance with your worldview, how does meditation and Buddhism help then?
Well, hopefully it does. I mean, yeah, of course. Otherwise, it would be kind of a sorry state, you know, if it was just like worked on the cushion and didn't work anywhere else. But I try to remember to breathe. I try to remember, I mean, this poor woman who felt responsible for me, you
know. Is that the woman that you're working with?
Yes, you know, who was doing the best she could. Compassion. Mm. She was doing absolutely the best she could. And even the taxi driver who seemed under duress and not in the best mind state, you know, it was just like, okay, let's not make this worse.
So you try not to, in that exact instance, you're not overly identifying with your own worldview. But are you still, one could say, biochemically feeling like, I'm a bit annoyed about this happening, this shouldn't be going on, and then going, don't respond to that, or you're not even feeling that anymore?
No, I feel, well, partly because I felt responsible to you. I wanted to be here on time, you know, but I wasn't going to be, and things like that. So, of course, I feel it, but, and I think he could have been nicer, but if he you know, really knew how to be nicer, he might have been.
I've never thought of Russell Brand as Bambi before, but that's an image I'm going to find hard to shake. Thank you for that, Mike. Jess?
We're allowed to talk about radio as opposed to
of
podcasts.
Course,
okay, good.
Naturally.
I mean, I could have talked about this program at any time over the last 10 or 15 years, and I've actually been waiting for this opportunity to do so because I think it's a bit of a hidden gem, something Michael will be familiar with, and that is Up All Night with Rod Sharp. I'm a little bit of an insomniac, or at least I fall asleep, but I wake up in the middle of the night. And
That's because you're a man of a certain age.
Yeah, yes. Well, it's been going on for a long while, and hence it's probably my favourite radio programme. I think it is absolutely brilliant. It's got so many great... First of all, it's just him, and he does this programme from the States. That's from a little coastal town somewhere in the States, isn't he? And he's such a brilliant journalist. He's so well informed, he's so erudite, he's so nice, and he just kind of checks in with stories all around the world. And of course, because it's the middle of the night here, you know, other bits of the world are sort of awaking up, and there's no subject which is too big or small, too complex, too simple for him. And he just does whatever it is, 4 hours of just kind of moving around these different stories. It's brilliant. I don't know why he's not more lauded. I always think, I mean, I don't know if he's, no Sony's anymore. I don't know why he should be. He won every award going. He's an absolutely brilliant broadcaster, and I recommend it, even if you're not an insomniac, that you set your alarm and wake up at 1 o'clock and listen to Rod Sharp.
I've been speaking to Adam Candy, the editor of the Las Vegas Sun newspaper, and I asked him how surprised he was by this attack.
We've known in Las Vegas for a long time that we were a city that could be a target for this type of attack, and we prayed that it wouldn't be, and unfortunately that came home today.
Looking at the windows flapping, I mean, the video now of the Mandalay Hotel shows these two windows, which he's apparently hammered out, and the curtains are flapping through the windows. And yet we understand that it took police and SWAT teams an hour and more to actually get up there. Has that been sufficiently understood yet?
I think that time frame might be a bit exaggerated from when the shots were first recorded to when they finally got to the room. I think they had pinpointed that this was coming from Mandalay Bay, but of course, you're thinking of a property with more than 40 stories that they have to go sort of room by room and figure out where this person might be. So I do think attention will be paid to that in due time.
There's Rod Sharp on 5 Live. Did you want to mention another one?
I can just mention that. I mean, I'm a listener to the New York Times podcast with John Caramanica. And it's interesting. I've been sort of doing some thinking recently about other ways of getting into music, how you can do music journalism intelligently on the radio. And it's a good example of that, if somewhat frustrating, because it's a bit of a kind of... they had a series of critics on there, all showing off a little bit. But it's good because they go into it, they'll do a single issue, and that, again, could be just kind of women guitarists, or it might be, you know, one single Kanye West song, and they'll spend an hour talking about it and really sort of dissect it. And it's sometimes very annoying, but also quite provocative.
August 18th, 1969, that is Jimi Hendrix tackling, in maybe more ways than one, the national anthem at Woodstock, one of the most iconic performances of the national anthem, and in a week where that song has become the locus of so much controversy, it seems like a good moment to maybe step back and talk a little bit about the song, what its original intentions were, what its meanings have been manipulated to be, and how people have interpreted it both positively and with critique over the years, Hendrix being perhaps foremost among them. So on this week's podcast, we're going to have some call-in guests to talk about the national anthem. First, we're going to have Mark Ferris. Mark is a historian and author who has written a book called Star Spangled Banner, The Unlikely Story of America's National Anthem. And he is going to talk with us a little bit about the history of the song and its uses, and I would probably say misuses. And then later, we are going to talk to Megan Lindsay. Megan is the singer who last Sunday at the Tennessee Titans game, following her performance of the Star Spangled Banner, took a knee. She was one of two singers that weekend.
There's podcast from the New York Times. I must say the New York Times Daily as well is on fine form. I think that's become a must listen for me. Any other business before we depart, gentlemen? By the way, there will be women on the panel next time. Adam Bowie, Michael Hill and Jez Nelson, thank you very much for being our panel for the October roundtable. We'll have the news now. Here is Stuart Clarkson. And by the way, Stu, thanks for sitting in so capably for the last 3 weeks.
Thank you, Trevor, and welcome back. This week, Ofcom's received two declarations of interest for the local FM commercial licence in Ipswich. Current holder Town 102, which is owned by Celador now, will have to go up against an application from Muxco Suffolk, which runs the local DAB multiplex there. Meanwhile, Celador's also facing a challenge for its Breeze licence in Bristol, with Nation Broadcasting saying it intends to apply for that one. Scott Mills has been lined up for a live conversation with David Lloyd later this month. The free event on October the 18th in Leeds is part of the two-day Segway event taking place ahead of the Arias, which Scott is hosting. Also announced this week, Busted will be the headline music act at the Arias. Digital Radio UK's Doing the Dab event is heading to Belfast next. Previous sessions have been held in Manchester, Glasgow, Birmingham, Liverpool, and this week Cardiff. The Belfast one's booked in for November 17th. Sound Digital is looking for two new DAB Plus stations to join its national multiplex. It's to replace capacity that was going to be used by Awesome Radio, which now isn't launching. Tributes have been paid this week to the BBC Radio Wales presenter Alan Thompson, who's died after a short illness. He presented the evening show on the station for 4 years, championing Welsh music acts. Alan started out on the radio making music packages for the Radio 5 show Rave in the early 90s. The former Metro, Real Radio and Atlantic 252 presenter Mark Henry has been jailed this week for 4 years after admitting 5 counts of assault causing ABH against his partner. He'd most recently been on air at Wish FM in Wigan, but left in the summer. New shows this week for Sam and Amy on Virgin, which has new jingles and a new strapline. It's all about the music. And Dave Berry, who's finally finished his gardening leave and started on Home Time at Absolute Radio. Former long-serving Magic presenter Gary Vincent has joined Global this week to host evenings on Smooth Radio. He takes over from Chris Skinner. Gary was at Magic for the last 14 years. Katie Derham has joined BBC Radio 3's Drive Time programme, In Tune. She moves from Afternoons to replace Susie Klein, who's now fronting Essential Classics with Rob Cowan. And Emma Louise Jones is swapping Hull for Stoke this month as she joins Signal One Breakfast alongside John Fox. Emma's been on Viking Breakfast with Alex Duffy for the last couple of years. And you'll find more details about some of the things I've mentioned, plus other radio news updated daily at radiotoday.co.uk.
Thank you very much, Stuart Clarkson. Now, here's where we would normally bring you David Lloyd's Radio Moments, but we've whiffled on for so long this week, we can't get it in within our 1 hour slot. So I'm going to have to post that as a Radio Today programme extra later on. And it is worth finding because David's dug out some fascinating clips about the other BBC networks who've been celebrating their 50th anniversaries. So thanks for listening to this pod. Hope you enjoyed it. The levels were a bit quaint in places, weren't they? Apologies for that. We'll do better next time.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.